Welcome to the Arthroscopy Association's Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association nor the Arthroscopy Journal, and they're not meant to be used as treatment recommendations for patients. Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Travis Decker, coming from the United States Air Force Academy. And today I'll be joined by a friend, colleague, mentor, fellow New Mexican, and somebody I actually grew up with, Dustin Richter. He's an amazing teacher and advocate for his trainees with both residents and his fellows. The reviews that I get back from those that have trained under him just kind of, they rave about him. And I think that speaks a lot to those of us that are faculty and involved in academics, for those that speak so highly of someone like Dustin. He currently serves as the fellowship director and head team physician for the University of New Mexico Department of Orthopedics. And he's wise beyond his years and is a huge advocate for sports medicine across both societies, and specifically a huge advocate for healthcare within New Mexico, which for those of us who are from there, we understand and know that it has its own unique set of challenges. So I'm very excited to be welcoming my friend. Welcome to the podcast, Dustin.
Hey, thanks, Travis. It's truly an honor to be here. It's great to have this opportunity to discuss orthopedics and sports medicine, like you said, with a friend from Albuquerque who only grew up a few blocks away from me. That's pretty neat and pretty unique circumstances. And likewise, you know, I've enjoyed following your career and where you're landing, and you're doing some really great work. So congratulations to you, and thanks for the invite.
Well, I appreciate it. We'll get rock and rolling, but we have to definitely give a shout out to our mutual mentor, Dr. Bob Skank, who I'll get on here eventually as well. But I think without his mentorship and guidance, especially for us as individuals, but even through that department, has just meant so much to New Mexico and New Mexico healthcare, New Mexico orthopedics, and love seeing his next transition and his journey of his career, and look forward to seeing what he'll do as he's a close family friend and just a great, great human. So,
Thanks for giving him a shout out. You know, he's truly one of the goats, I think, in orthopedics. And he's the whole reason that I went into medicine, period. You know, I spent some time with him and I said, you know what, I want to be an orthopedic sports medicine surgeon someday because of him. And it worked out. So Bob's done a lot of great things, and congratulations on his retirement, but he's still very actively involved in the education and research aspects.
Yeah, he's truly one of a kind. But now we get to highlight you, one of his true mentees, and it'll be fun to go through your article that you did with your crew down in New Mexico. We're going to be looking specifically at your article from 2018. Where you looked at primary anterolateral ligament rupture in patients requiring revision anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, a retrospective case control magnetic resonance imaging review. There, Dustin, you and your authors, you took a deeper dive into the lateral-sided structures of the knee. Really, as this started to become to the forefront in evaluating primary ACL injuries. So one of my favorite things to do with any of these podcasts is specifically to go through the history and kind of the background of what you guys were thinking at that time, especially 2018, and what really kind of drove this study.
Yeah, you bet. It's kind of interesting. So the study was done when I was a fellow at University of Virginia, but my chief year of residency was 2015. And at that time, you know, we had started exploring the ALL in a little bit more detail. Seemed like the literature, even though we know that it had been described a long time ago, came back around and was becoming more prominent. And we were looking at reconstruction techniques at University of New Mexico, my chief year, with Dr. Garen Trimmy, who is a great friend and colleague. So I had a couple exposures to it and had done a couple reconstructions with a free graft at that point. And then I went to fellowship at University of Virginia. And while we were there, they actually had not started doing any lateral procedures yet, no lateral tenodesis or ALL reconstructions. And about halfway through my fellowship, as part of our educational conference, I gave a presentation on the ALL and the latest research, the anatomy, surgical techniques, kind of everything related to it. And that was really what prompted us to start talking more about it as a group at that time. And the first author on the paper, Dr. James Beamer Carr, he was a resident on the service at the time. And when I gave this presentation, he and I started talking and came up with this idea together that, you know what, let's see if we can evaluate the ALL on MRI and then correlate ALL injury rates at the time of presentation to see if they correlate to risk of ACL graft rupture after patients underwent an ACL reconstruction. This was a retrospective study, but I have to give a lot of credit to Beamer Carr and then a medical student at the time, Barris Yildirim, who really ran with the study and knocked it out.
You know, it started to become pretty popular for me, and I was a few years after you up in Vail. Mm-hmm. And it was still, we were doing revision ACLs, the gold standard with either BTB or even with quad revisions at that time. And it was interesting to see the trend starting to move much in a much more popular direction mm-hmm. to start doing these. And I think we started adopting these in these high risk patients and then the revisions. And then we started looking at this in primary injuries. And I think that's one of the things that I remember first year of practice calling Dr. LaPrade, always asking him questions and pestering that poor soul too many times. I mean, the guy's the smartest surgeon and truly the best knee surgeon I've ever seen. He's like one of the guys that can back up what his research is. Like, the guy's just a technician. He's just amazing. But I asked him, I was like, hey, I've got this like 16-year-old girl who's hyperlax and she wants to do lacrosse and she wants to go play at college. And she's just like, I see this girl and I did this study when I was at Duke and every like a quarter of them fail. Like, how is this acceptable? Like, how can we do this? And so it started to intrigue me more, primary lateral sided procedures. But then when we look across the spectrum, you're like, everybody makes fun of sports surgeons that the only thing we can talk about is ACL reconstruction. Like, we'd run out of things to talk about if we ran out of the idea of talking about ACL reconstructions. Because we keep trying to refine a procedure in a primary setting that works almost like 90 to 95% of the time, which is awesome. And like, but I think we know the consequences of those 5 to 10% that do fail. And so, and how drastically those results fall off. And it's just been interesting to really kind of go through that. But can you, you know, I mentioned some of the consequences of that, but can you kind of go through what your mindset has been and your evolution of how you've looked at these TNDCs or these augmented procedures to help prevent failure? It specifically, like, why we keep looking at how we can make an ACL reconstruction better.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. You know, it's truly kind of funny to me too, that there are procedures that we do that have a much lower success rate, but we don't give as much of our time and research and stuff like that to them to understand how can we get this to such a high level of success. And with all of this fine tuning, when we talk about, well, graft selection and do we need to go back to looking at repair and adding additional ligaments around the knee, you know, how much are we truly moving the needle as far as successful outcomes? But I think a lot of this, the reason that we continue to look at it is that when you take all comers like we did in this paper, it's a low re-tear rate, you know, maybe 5 to 10%. We had 6.5%. I normally quote my patients about a 7% rate of re-injury to their ACL. But if you truly focus on, you know, the young athlete, and I think that's who, if you do ACLs and you aren't getting failures, either you're not honest with yourself or you're not treating the young pivoting athlete. And that's really who we need to look at. Because revision rates in that population can be as high as 25%. We know that return to sport may only be 65% to the same prior level. That's because of both physical and psychosocial reasons. Some of the high schoolers are now finishing school and they don't want to compete in college. So there's a variety of reasons, but those are still results that are less successful than we'd like. So I think, you know, the best shot at getting the ACL done right and getting good knee stability with a successful outcome is going to be at your initial surgery. So we have to look at all of the potential reasons for graft failure, We know that with re-tears and in the revision setting, it's drastically lowered patient satisfaction, return to sport, risk of complications, risk of re-rupture. So it's really, let's try and get it right the first time.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that we see the consequences. And also, I think you had talked about a little bit about the psychosocial dynamics of these athletes. And I think highlighting the importance of the young athlete, the teenager, high-risk athlete, I think maybe less so the idea of them just getting a functional ACL. And yes, we know that they have higher risk of re-tear, but it is like life-altering for them because they're kind of at that one time in their life that they can play sports, that they're going to be involved in these competitive sports that with the majority of which don't go on to play the next level. Like, and right. Whether or not they have a perfect knee or they have a reconstructed knee. So I think it has a lot. We are advocates for team sports and for people playing sports and the benefits of that. So it really is like you are doing this as a lifestyle type procedure too, so they can compete and play and develop and get all those secondary benefits from sporting activities. And
yeah, I think, couldn't agree more. You know, you're taking a year at least out of someone's life here.
Yes.
That's pretty significant, especially when you're young.
Yeah. Like I always, those difficult conversations are those juniors in high school that are getting ready to gear up to be recruited for the next level. Or same thing in the college level. They're like at their junior, senior year, and they need that next year so they can try and go to the next level. It's like that ACL injury comes in. You're just like, oh my God, this is like heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. And you know you have to do the right thing, but whew, man, those are tough conversations to have. And I think, like you said, if we're seeing these as freshmen and sophomores in high school, knowing that they may give them the opportunity to have that again, like, God, you don't want to have that conversation again where now they're literally half their time in high school is taken out because of a knee injury. So,
those conversations never get easier.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, on specifically to your paper, you know, there's a couple of things that I noticed. And I think if the listeners were to go through and really kind of go through your paper and understand the background for it and then go look through the methods, especially for what we're looking at now, I think there'll be some interesting things. So can you kind of go through how your patients specifically were chosen for analysis? And then one thing that I found a particular interest, because I just haven't seen it very often, and what was your specific interest in identifying the location of the tear of the ALL, whether it was femoral-sided, mid-substance, or tibial-sided?
Yeah, excellent question. So regarding study design and selection criteria, this was a retrospective study. We pulled all isolated ACL reconstructions that were done over a 7-year period at University of Virginia, and that was by 5 different surgeons. That amounted to almost 2,000 patients. We identified the patients who required a revision ACL due to graft rupture that were in the system, and that was 128 patients. So that worked out to about 6.5%. Of those 128 patients, 55 of the patients, so 43%, had MRI scans available for review, so an MRI from their initial injury. So when we look at exclusion criteria, we excluded patients who had chronic ACL tears, so this was really an acute group, and chronic was identified as more than 3 months out from injury. If the initial primary MRI was not available, that was an exclusion. And that's really what whittled down the majority of patients, is if their MRI was not available in our system. And then we excluded multi-ligament knee injuries. And we only looked at patients between the ages of 13 and 50. So we identified that group, and then we obtained a matched cohort of patients who had undergone a primary ACL reconstruction who did not go on to graft rupture as far as we know. And they were paired with age, gender, as well as the ACL graft type. So at the end of this, we ended up with 39 patients in each group that met the inclusion exclusion criteria. And 26 of them in each group were hamstring reconstructions, 13 in each group were BTB. And then to your second point, why we chose to look at the tear location. So this is really out of what we've started to learn from some of the other ligaments around the knee, is that are some of these tears potentially amenable to healing on their own? And can the ALL and the lateral complex heal down? And are others ones that require a repair or reconstruction technique? So we've seen with MCL injuries that femoral-sided injuries tend to heal better than tibial-sided injuries. There's been recent studies on the posterolateral corner that show repair of tibial-sided avulsion injuries may actually do okay. And that kind of challenges some of the dogma that we've seen in the literature prior with multi-ligament knee injuries that have a high failure rate with repair, but that's all comers. So maybe there's certain ones that can do better with repair. And I think that this could potentially guide what patients needed a reconstruction or repair versus allowing things to heal down and doing an isolated ACL.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fascinating thought to be able to use that as maybe even like a predictor of patients that may or may not need an extra procedure. Because we're still trying to refine exactly who needs a lateral-sided procedure anyways. Mm-hmm. And people are going to look at different factors, and can we find radiographic or imaging factors that could help predict that? And who would then go on to need a lateral sided procedure? I think is an awesome thought. And then food for thought as well is, does the injury pattern change when it is a multi-ligament injury? I think just hearing you talk about that in that response was like, I wonder if it would change based off a primary isolated ACL versus a multi-ligament knee injury.
Yeah, I imagine it would. You know, we were actually talking about that as a group this morning, that we were talking specifically about ACL and MCL injuries and how not everything's created equal. And when you look at an ACL with the typical pivot shift contusion versus ACL MCLs that maybe have more edema or maybe only a contusion on the tibial or the femoral side, but not your standard pivot shift. You know, it's a different mechanism for sure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, not all multi-ligs are created equal by any means.
Yeah, for sure. So are you, with all of your patients that are coming in with knee injuries or known ACL injuries, because most radiologists aren't really commenting on any of the ALL structures.
Right.
So are you guys routinely identifying them and then commenting on the status of the ALL?
Yeah, I would say the short answer is no. Early on, immediately after fellowship, I'd try to look at the ALL in a little bit more detail. And I'll look to see if there's, you know, a clear Sagan fracture on x-rays. But I'm no longer interrogating the ALL. And I think some of it's just the findings of this paper, but then also knowing that there have been other good clinical studies that we can discuss a little bit more later, but some good clinical studies that have come out, which have helped guide my management a little bit more. And I think with any MRIs, you know, this study, although I like to think that it was overall done well, it's still an MRI study without really the clinical or surgical correlation with it. So MRIs, as you know, Travis, they can overcall or undercall pathology, and especially if the ligaments are stretched. So they may appear normal on imaging, but maybe the tissue is no longer functional, or conversely, maybe that tissue does have the ability to heal down.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think we're going to continue to see even imaging studies based off of this and how we can reliably identify it. And are there certain views that we should be looking at, or flexion angles of the knee or different cut slices and, to be able to do that.
Because there is, you know, you look at the literature and you're right, there has to be more imaging studies to identify what's best to look at, because there's still a pretty low inter and intra rater reliability in a lot of studies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's start out with your findings. And what did you all find? As I think the listeners may be a bit surprised about what your findings actually kind of came to yield.
Yeah. Yeah. So the hypothesis of our paper was that a higher rate of ALL injury at the time of initial ACL tear would be present in patients who went on to experience an ACL graft failure after reconstruction. But the results actually refuted our hypothesis. So we found that initial MRIs revealed a similar incidence of ALL rupture between both the revision as well as the control groups. So in the revision group, patients had an intact ALL, 17 of them, which was actually the very similar number to the control group, which had 18. And then patients who had partial tears or complete tears of the ALL in the revision group was 22 compared to 21 in the control group. So similar numbers. One thing that was interesting, it did not meet statistical significance, but when you talk about the location of the tear, the mid-substance tear was the most common in both groups. So 13 patients in each group had a mid-substance tear of the ALL. But in the group that required revision, they had 5 tibial-sided injuries, 3 of which were Sagan fractures. And in the control group that did not go on to revision, they had only 1 tibial-sided injury, no Sagan fracture, and 8 of those were femoral-sided injuries in the control group. So a little bit of a different distribution on location.
And can you kind of take us through what you found in terms of the failure rates for these?
Yeah. So what we found with the study is that no matter whether or not they had complete, partial, or intact ALL, that there was no difference in going on to graft failure rates. So as far as statistical significance, there was no difference in the frequency of ALL rupture between the two cohorts or the rupture location between the two cohorts.
Yeah, I mean, that I found that fascinating because I assumed, even starting out to read your paper, that I was like, oh yeah, their hypothesis is just kind of seems like it's a no-brainer that you have disruption of your ALL. Like, I don't know maybe where the disruption would be, if it would lead to higher risk of failure in a primary ACL. But when I saw it, I was like, huh, that's interesting. There's more to learn and figure out about this. So yeah, I thought that is super interesting findings. And also then makes me question about, like, when do I start adding lateral sided procedures in? So
I'd agree with you. You know, I think it's important to publish some of these results, you know, with even the negative findings where it refutes your hypothesis and you go in. You know, we focus so much on what comes out with positive ones, but this study showing that there's no difference between the groups, that's important information too.
Oh, I think very valuable. And I mean, these are going to lead to biomechanical studies and for asking further questions. And I'm sure with you, you're involved with trainees on a daily basis. I think that's part of the fun of teaching is you have a paper like this and you're going to have a resident from the most junior level to some senior high level fellow that's going to come up with some interesting question that will help answer another clinical question. And yeah, so true. I think that when you've shown that the ALL disruption at initial time of injury doesn't necessarily demonstrate that difference when you're looking at those who go on to failure, we've talked about this briefly offline, but can you talk a little bit about how this has modified your practice and what you do? And so, like, what are your indications for adding in a lateral sided procedure, whether it's an ALL or LAT in a primary patient?
Yeah, great question. And this is something that seems to come up more and more at conferences and meetings now. You know, it seems like the literature continually evolves. And even in just the last 5 years, it's changed so much. We've learned so much. Like you talked about, biomechanical studies have shown that normal knee kinematics are only restored after ALL reconstruction has been added to the ACL and ALL combined injury. Otherwise, you have some continued rotational laxity. Al Gitgood, a good friend, I think everyone's aware of his landmark Stability 1 study that looked at ACL reconstruction with hamstring grafts with or without adding the lateral extra-articular tendinitis and showing the significantly decreased re-tear rates in that group. So both of those, the biomechanical clinical studies, have really helped shape my practice a lot. I started off with doing ALL reconstruction with a free graft, but I really moved almost solely to doing a modified Lemaire iliotibial band lateral extra-articular tendinitis. And I think, you know, the key with these is getting the tissue deep to the fibular collateral ligament. It's easy to add to surgery, has minimal risk and complications. And, you know, one of the potential risks that people have discussed is, are you closing down or overloading that lateral compartment? And there's some recent literature just this year that's started to debunk that theory that, you know, we probably aren't. And it's probably not leading to any long-term risk of arthritis. So, you know, I look forward to the Stability 2 data that's going to look at quad versus BTD for the graft with or without an LET. And I think that's going to just further guide our management and treatment. As far as you said, what are my indications for adding it? You know, I wasn't an early adopter, but I've been really impressed over the last several years, especially in the pivoting athletes and the young athletes. So like we said, you want to try and get it right the first time. So now I kind of joke around that I may even lean more on the side of who does not need an LET. Now, you know, that's a little tongue in cheek, but at the same time, I'm expanding my indication certainly for it. Initially, it was really strict indications for a Sagan fracture, a grade 3 pivot shift, or the revision setting, revision ACL, probably for the hyperlax patients. But now I do it for all high school and college athletes who compete in higher level sporting activity, particularly that cutting and pivoting, definitely for the hyperlax patients. I'm looking at tibial slope. If they have a higher tibial slope, I'm using that as an indication. If they have a large meniscus tear, a bucket handle tear, meniscal deficiencies, especially medial meniscus, with that being a secondary stabilizer, I'm adding it. And then if I'm doing hamstring grafts in older patients who want to go back to skiing, snowboarding, or similar activities. So it's really been a quite powerful and a pretty large part of my practice.
Even hearing you chat about it, we have very similar indications, and hearing you talk about increased posterior tibial slope. And I think we're just looking at essentially if there's anything that we've identified in the past as a prior increased risk factor for primary ACL failure, I think a lot of us are tending to ask ourselves and question ourselves, why not add it?
Mm-hmm. Agree. Why not?
And yeah. I think that there's so many confounding factors about the overconstraint of the joint with that wisp of IT band that we talk about, and is the arthritis forming from? I mean, we already have known arthritic changes in the knee even with an ACL injury. Period. So is it the LET that's doing that, or is it the ALL that's doing that, or is that just from the injury itself? So there's a lot of confounding factors that I think are going to be impossible to really nail down. But I'm sure there's plenty of trainees out there that are much smarter than us that are, I'm sure, will figure that out. But that being said, I think that it's become a little bit like the remplissage of the shoulder. People are asking themselves, why not? And with low risk profile, with technical proficiency, being able to add this on quickly, so it's not a huge time sink. You're not putting the patient at a significant increased risk of anesthesia and downtime. You know, I think that we're still going to learn, and there's still going to be some recovery questions, and there's going to be things that we figure out over time. But geez, it's hard to argue in a high risk patient. So a cutting, pivoting young athlete that we kept talking about, where we need to be critical of our results. Man, if we could drive that percentage of failure down from 25% to even a percentage that we would still deem not acceptable at like 10% or 12%, that's a huge win for the numbers of people that are out there that are doing this. Like, holy cow, huge. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, like you said, you know, we're adding so many things to our ACL that the days of doing a 45 minute to 60 minute ACL and putting in your graft and everything are almost gone, because you're doing an ACL reconstruction with autograft, you're doing a lateral tenodesis, save the meniscus and doing repairing ramp lesions. There's a lot more work and stuff that's been identified to add to the whole ACL picture.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to hit on this just one more time. And I think that it specifically within the primary ACL injury, because I think this is, for me, might be a little bit of a particular interest of future research. Primary ACL injury, location of ALL tear. What are your thoughts on the mechanistic differences in an isolated ACL injury of where that tear is occurring?
Yeah. You know, I think, like you said, this is going to be an area for hopefully some future research, future biomechanical studies, and imaging studies looking at it. Because even though it didn't show any statistically significant differences, it was interesting to see that subset of patients with more tibial-sided injuries and Sagan fractures who went on to require a revision ACL, whereas it was almost all of the femoral-sided injuries in the control group, you know, when we're not counting for the mid-substance tears. So it does correlate, again, like we talked about, with what we've learned and are learning about ligament injuries in general around the knee. And I think it lends some support to the ALL and the lateral capsular complex that it may have the ability to heal. But in those that it doesn't heal, is that another predictor, like you and I were saying, about who may or may not need an LET or similar reconstruction for it? So again, you know, I think that this study sets a basis for hopefully some future studies, but it's certainly a major limitation is with only the MRI outcomes reported, none of the return to play data. And, you know, there's not a surgical correlation because we don't dissect out the ALL at the time of surgery to look at it and evaluate it. So I think this sets a basis for other studies, but these findings certainly need to be interpreted with some caution.
Well, I wanted to hit on one of the technical components that you had mentioned too, because this has become an evolution in watching a variety of videos from just world famous surgeons. And then I talked to Jorge Chala in the lab and picking his brain at how he does it. And everybody has a little bit of a different flair on how they're doing this isolated lateral procedure when they're doing it. Mm-hmm. I think that, like, with a modified Lemaire, which is what I've adopted and I've done, how are you finding, what are you using as your femoral landmark in a modified Lemaire?
Yeah. So I think, you know, when you make that incision in the mid aspect of the iliotibial band and you take your graft, leaving it attached distally to Gerdes, then you work through that defect in the IT band to feel the medial femoral epicondyle. And then if you go just proximal and posterior to that, you know, there's a lot of tissue over that spot, but I take a Bovie and I actually make that essentially naked and take all that tissue off of there so that I can feel a little flat spot just on the proximal posterior aspect of the lateral femoral epicondyle. And then that's what I'm using as my landing spot on the femur.
Got it. Now, do you get worried about convergence with your ACL tunnel?
Certainly. And I've had them converge before. So that's not a fun thing when that happens. So what I have started doing, so unlike, you know, when I do an MPFL, let's say, I like to do a pull-through technique for that on the femur. I don't like doing that for my ALL or for the modified Lemaire. So I do something so that if they do get close to each other, that you're kind of pushing bone towards each other as opposed to violating the tunnel. And what I mean by that is that I'll either use a staple. We're involved in the Stability 2 research trial, and we're using a staple for all of those. So I'll use a staple on those patients, which I think has lower risk of, you know, getting into your graft and having problems. I'll use a suture anchor, or, you know, recently I've used these small knee suture anchors that have a little loop that you pop in this anchor, pull your graft through the loop, cinch down the loop, and then you can pull it back over itself and suture it for a little backup fixation. And that's been a really nice technique.
Yeah, that suture staple. I know when I was working with Dr. Laprade, he was big on using the staple, and he was... Travis just find distal Kaplan fibers every time. It's the easiest thing in the world to ever find. And for him, the savant that he is, it is. And, you know, it's, and I've seen, which is a little bit higher than that, but as close as you can get it to the lateral epicondyle becomes more isometric. And so when I was talking with Jorge, he's like, well, if you look at it, the in his very normal, very academic way. It's just like, you know, if the lateral sided ALL is not a perfectly isometric structure. So just get it. You just need to make sure that your proximal and posterior to the lateral epicondyle, and it'll be fine, because when it's on tension, that's what will prevent the pivot. And it's just, and Jorge is just a brilliant man. And
he's done a lot of great work also.
Goodness. And like, so to hear him talk about it and just say, let's keep things simple. Let's keep it. Where is it important to be on tension? Where does it prevent that rotation? I think there might be a little bit more leeway in that lateral sided and some forgiveness in that lateral sided procedure compared to like an ACL, where we're wanting to get tunnels within a millimeter where we need to be, which I think for us is nice. And it gives us a backup to be able to make sure that we're doing right by our patients and preventing that problem and that injury. So,
Yeah. And I think trying to get it as close to anatomic as we can. But knowing that we're talking about a millimeter here, there, and then you're still making a tunnel or whatever it may be to the half centimeter to centimeter in size. So doing our best to get it there, but there's probably a little wiggle room.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dustin, I can't thank you enough. It's fun to be on a podcast with a fellow Albuquerquean, fellow New Mexican, a guy that I went to high school with, and really take it back to a lot of mutual friends and family friends and mentors. And I love the University of New Mexico. And I think the Department of Orthopedics has just been such a strong point and educational component for throughout all of orthopedics. And so I want to thank you for kind of continuing to carry the Skank and Treme torch through the sports medicine department that you have there. Like, just the most approachable, nice, common sense individuals I've ever met within sports medicine, and really appreciate your early career contributions and obviously their long-term career contributions that they've had, and always love to see what the University of New Mexico has to produce. And just really appreciate you taking the time today out of your busy Friday to work with me on this and to chat about your findings. And I think talk about something that's going to continue to be more popular as these next 5 to 10 years come to play for knee surgery.
Yeah, you bet, Travis. I can't thank you enough for the kind words that you said. I feel like we do have something truly special here at UNM, and the colleagues that I got are second to none. And then, you know, thinking all my collaborators at University of Virginia and where I cut my teeth in fellowship, and that was a fantastic group. So I really enjoyed today's discussion and love getting to catch up with one of my buddies from back home.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the time. And today, the listeners, it was a real privilege to go over Dr. Richter's arthroscopy article entitled Primary Anterolateral Ligament Rupture in Patients Requiring Revision ACL Reconstruction, a Retrospective Case Control MRI Review. This can currently be accessed at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. And just remember, the views expressed in this podcast don't necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal, and they're not necessarily meant to be used as treatment recommendations for patients. So once again, thank you all for joining us, and I hope you all have a great day.